before noon, that is, when a well-dressed woman, perhaps in her early 40s, a woman with auburn hair, a strong chin, high cheekbones, and violet eyes, came up to him and said,
"Are you by any chance the writer Henry James?"
Blinking at being recognized in public, not something that happened to him in America, James said,
"Why, yes, I am."
He was about to tip his hat to her when the woman took an ugly-looking and obviously heavy revolver pistol from her cloth handbag and aimed at James's belly.
"Take out the key," she said. "Open these two gates, and then take me up."
James hurried to comply, although he almost fumbled and dropped the key at the outer gate and fussed too long with the elevator cage door as well. She all but pushed him into the lift cage and stepped in behind him, the pistol still trained on him.
"Take me up," she said. "Quickly."
James jerked the lever too far to the left, causing the car to lurch up like a rocket, and then he compensated too far to the right, causing it to slow to a near stop only 40 feet above the floor.
"Oh, for heaven's sake," snapped the woman,
moved James aside, and pushed the lever left so that the elevator hurtled upward. Lucan Adler, even leaner and more aquiline in profile than his famous father, had settled in against and partially behind the large searchlight, the Mauser braced on one of the light's metal ridges. Squeezed in between the observation deck's fence and the searchlight as Lucan was, Holmes doubted whether he offered a clear target to any of Drummond's men, even if they'd caught his brief movement out and up. Lucan finished adjusting the telescopic sight with a tiny screwdriver he set back into his shirt pocket. He was wearing no jacket of any kind, and held the Mauser aimed at the president, who was in the process of being introduced. But Lucan was also watching Sherlock Holmes approach and was smiling. When Holmes was about 25 long paces away, Lucan swung the rifle in his direction and said,
"Stop!"
Holmes stopped.
"I can get off three rounds in less than 2 seconds," said Lucan Adler,
and Holmes was surprised by the metallic sharpness of his voice, nothing like his mother's voice, perhaps more like his father's. Holmes could not be sure.
"Two into the fat boy president's chest, and the third round into your belly before you get 5 feet closer,"
added Lucan.
"If you move your hands toward your jacket or any pocket, I'll kill you first and put two or three rounds into the president before anyone looks up to see what the first noise was."
Holmes knew that he could and would do precisely that. He stood very still. The president had not begun his short address, but Director General Davis's introduction was winding down. Holmes knew, and Holmes knew that Lucan knew, that when Davis had introduced Cleveland and the oversized president actually stood at the podium, there'd be a full 90 seconds of Hail Columbia being played and the added time and noise of the audience's loud approval. The rifle shot killing Holmes during that time wouldn't be heard by anyone down there in the din, and probably not by Drummond's sharpshooters either. Holmes looked at the guy wire that ran from the post at the corner where Lucan hid himself and ran almost 300 feet out to the warning beacon in the lake. He'd known that Lucan would rig some device there, but the simplicity of it was impressive. Just a flywheel atop the wire within a welded, unfinished square of metal to hold the wheel on the cable, with a modified bicycle handlebars completely covered with rubber grips hanging below it.
"Elegant," said Holmes, nodding toward the escape apparatus.
He was sure that a fast powerboat was waiting at anchor next to that tiny beacon island of concrete.
"But the police and Secret Service already know about the Zephyr."
Lucan Adler shrugged and smirked.
"The Zephyr was always meant to be a distraction."
Davis introduced the president, and the band and chorus launched into Hail Columbia as the president came up to the low podium. Holmes did not turn his head to look over his right shoulder to see it. Lucan Adler raised the rifle higher, sighting it on Holmes's chest.
"Use just your left hand,"
Lucan said, just loud enough to be heard over the roar of noise below.
"And take off your jacket, waistcoat, and shirt. Quickly! If you don't have them all off in 30 seconds, I'll shoot."
Holmes's left hand fumbled with buttons and clasps, but before 30 seconds were up,
just a third of the scheduled time for the music and pre-presidential jubilation below, Holmes was standing naked from the waist up. Lucan continued looking through the sight.
2 exit wounds. Nice cluster for the distance. Turn around. Now!
Holmes turned and looked back toward the searchlight under which he'd hidden for the past 6 hours.
Oh, that third entry scar looks very nasty, Mr. Holmes, hissed Lucan. Is that bullet still in there? No, I think not. Did some humble Tibetan shepherd gouge around with a rusty spoon to dig it out? My, that must still be painful. Turn around and look at me. Now!
Holmes turned to face the young man, hardly more than a boy, but with the black marbled stare of a cobra. Holmes's hands hung loosely by his sides. The sunshine felt good on his naked upper body.
It makes more sense to kill you before I kill Cleveland,
Lucan said, obviously enjoying himself.
But it might be more fun to allow you to watch the president being shot and then dispatch you within those fast 2 seconds. What do you think, Mr. Detective?
Holmes said nothing. Behind him, the elevator doors opened. Henry James tried to remain in the elevator cage, but the woman, taller and stronger than he was, jerked him out by the arm and pulled him along as they walked east along the observation deck. There was Sherlock Holmes, facing the other way, his scars like rays radiating from the moon craters in the bright daylight, and Lucan Adler had swung the rifle in their direction.
Why, Mrs. Baxter, said Lucan with an audible sneer. Stop there by dear old dad, and keep that goddamn bulldog revolver pointed downward.
Stepping beyond Holmes so he could see her, Irene Adler aimed the pistol at Holmes's chest and said,
I don't want to point it downward. I want to point it at his heart.
She did just that. Lucan laughed, a sound like steel rending steel. Above the music and noise below, he said,
And you are Mr. Henry James, the writer, whom Holmes has been dragging around behind him this month, and more like a pet lamb on a string. Well, know that you will live out this day, Mr. James. I admire your writing. It is painful to read. I like pain. It should continue.
The music stopped. The crowd cheered, and then, like a tide shushing out, fell as quiet as it could. President Cleveland began to speak. He had a big, space-filling voice, said all the newspapers, but his words were inaudible at this distance. Mouse squeaks, followed by wild applause.
The target first,
muttered Lucan, and lifted and laid the Mauser along the flange of the searchlight, focusing on the president. Holmes knew that Cleveland's chest and belly would be filling Lucan's scope.
No, Holmes first,
cried Irene Adler, aiming the pistol at Holmes from only 7 or 8 feet away and cocking the bulldog pistol. At seeing her cock that hammer back, James reacted as he had never reacted before. He jumped at Irene Adler, managing to grab her wrist and force it down, even as he realized, too late, that she had already swiveled the pistol away from Holmes and at her son. The blast of the revolver deafened James. Instead of hitting Lucan Adler in the chest, where she'd been aiming, the deflected shot struck the young man's right foot. Lucan lost his balance and fell to the deck, but rolled like some jungle cat and came to one knee with the Mauser shouldered, swinging it their way. Holmes had begun sprinting toward Lucan before the pistol fired, but James saw in an instant that he wouldn't be able to cover the distance in time. Cursing in pain as he knelt there, but still holding the rifle with absolute confidence, Lucan Adler aimed and fired. James felt the bullet buzz past his right ear, and Irene Adler cried out and fell face forward. He had the presence of mind to look for the pistol, but she must have been lying on it. The wounded, cursing Lucan started to swing the rifle barrel at Holmes, but Holmes had closed the gap and kicked it aside. The heavy rifle went rattling across the paved promenade. Lucan had time to crouch, and suddenly there was a flat, deadly blade protruding from between the knuckles of his right hand. His right sleeve was torn, and James could see the elegant mechanism that had thrust the blade forward. He swung at Holmes's bare belly, and, although the detective arched his back like a bow, James could see blood fly. Lucan Adler turned, leaped over the fence, grabbed the bicycle grips, cut the restraining string with one swing of his bladed hand, and began plummeting out of sight down the long guy wire. Sherlock Holmes had not paused a second. With his blood still misting the air, he ran at the fence, jumped to its top, and leaped out into 200 feet of open space. 10. The unseen crowd of 100,000 people roared as if applauding Sherlock Holmes's suicide. Running toward the south fence beside the searchlight, Henry James saw in his peripheral vision huge flags unfurling from the agriculture and other giant buildings, the huge statue of the Republic in the lagoon directly south of him, finally dropping its veil, fountains leaping into life. Part of him realized that President Cleveland had lived long enough to depress the gold telegraph key on its velvet pillow. Later, James had the thought that any true gentleman would have first checked the condition of Mrs. Irene Adler Lorne Baxter and helped her if he could. But at that moment, Henry James didn't give the least goddamn about the condition of Lucan Adler's mother. He reached the fence at the southeast corner of the building and gasped. Holmes hadn't been able to leap far enough to get his hands on the rubber-tipped bicycle handlebar. Instead, one hand caught Lucan Adler's belt, the other hand gripped his shirt collar. The collar came off, and the shirt ripped down the seam, even as Lucan began to twist his body toward Holmes. With Lucan's sleeve torn open, James now saw the knife mechanism strapped on his forearm work again, slipping a wide, flat blade between the assassin's knuckles. Holmes swung himself around like the already turning killer and began clambering up Lucan's front like a monkey on a man-shaped climbing bar. His right hand now had a grip around Lucan's neck, pulling the younger man's head down like a lover enforcing a kiss, even while his left shifted quickly from Lucan's belt to grab his right wrist, arresting the blade. But not quickly enough to avoid another wound, James saw blood mist the air again, Holmes's blood. Henry James looked around wildly. Part of his mind had recorded the sound of the elevator going down, and now it was arriving at this level again. But that meant nothing to James. Irene Adler was still lying face down, possibly dead. James saw the Mauser rifle. He quickly picked it up. Dear Christ, it was heavy. And laid it across the top of the metal fence to steady himself while he tried to look through the telescopic sight. Holding the wood under the barrel tightly, he worked the well-oiled and expertly assembled bolt. A complete bullet, James could see the lead points with little X's gouged into them, ejected and landed under the German searchlight. For all James knew, that was the last live round in the rifle. He didn't have time to check, nor did he wonder, as anyone who knew firearms would have, just how far off true the telescopic sight had been knocked in all its being thrown here and there. For a moment, nothing made sense, and then, fuzzy but solid in the circle, there were Holmes and Lucan spinning as the single-wheeled mechanism flew down the cable. Lucan's white shirt was torn to tatters and covered with blood. Holmes's blood, James realized. Holmes's bare skin was as white, torn, and blood-spattered as his opponent's shirt. The only reason they hadn't reached the bottom of this long, guy-wired slide was that Lucan's wheel mechanism hadn't been designed for so much weight. It lurched along at high speed for 30 or 40 feet, then caught, almost stopped, then lurched down and forward again. The two men were fighting more like animals than men. When they were still moving quickly, Holmes grabbed Lucan's right wrist and forced the metal release for the knuckle knife up against the wire. Sparks flew. The blade mechanism bent into itself and was now of little use in the fighting. Lucan switched his right hand to the handlebar and began to pound on Holmes's lower head and shoulders with his free hand, even as Holmes locked his legs around Lucan Adler and clambered up his bloody front. The two men butted heads, bit at each other. Lucan used the fingers of his left hand to claw at Holmes's eye, even as Holmes freed his left hand long enough to swing its wedge into Lucan's throat. James realized that sweat had clouded his vision. He wiped at his right eye and found the two men in the circular scope again. Their pulley had slowed, and they twisted while they fought, bit, kicked, and gouged. But then the wheel seemed to free itself and began falling again toward the still distant Beacon Island in Lake Michigan. James saw whiteness fill the telescopic sight, thought that it was, might be, the back of Lucan Adler. He held his breath and squeezed the trigger. He'd not had the butt of the Mauser pressed solidly to his shoulder, and now the recoil knocked him backwards from his half-crouch and firmly onto his rear end. 130 feet down the 240-foot guy wire, Holmes had grasped the handlebar and pulled himself up to Lucan's level. The two men were now face to face, Lucan grinning wildly as they fought with elbows, fists, headbutts, and knees. Lucan had been working on the knife mechanism, and now he had the blade firmly between his knuckles again, his left hand locked firmly on the bicycle bar. Holmes's left-handed grip on the bar was more tenuous and left him unable to defend the bare left side of his upper body.
"Die, goddamn you!"
screamed Lucan Adler, bringing the blade around in a thrust that would reach Holmes's heart. Holmes said something Lucan couldn't make out. It might have been, "God forgive me," or "God forgive you," but whatever the words were, they meant nothing now that the killing blow was already in motion. Suddenly, a bullet ripped through the narrow space between the two men, tore a furrow through Lucan's upper right arm and shirt, and ripped its way across the back of Holmes's dropping right hand. The impact was just enough to turn Lucan's dagger thrust to Holmes's heart into a razor-sharp slashing motion that cut through flesh and skidded across a rib. Holmes pulled the tiny lemon squeezer cyclist's pistol from his right trouser pocket, pressed it hard into Lucan's belly, high at the diaphragm, just below where the assassin's heavily muscled flesh met bone, squeezed the pistol's hand grip tightly to release its silly lemon squeezer safety, and fired twice into Lucan Adler's body. James realized that Drummond and some of his gray-suited men had run up to him while two others were checking on the still unconscious Irene Adler. Drummond heard the two pistol shots, but was sure it was a double echo of his own rifle shot. Drummond helped him to his feet, just as Lucan Adler, still 70 feet in the air, opened his arms and fell away. Holmes was clinging weakly to the pulley device's handlebars as it picked up speed toward the buoy post. Lucan fell gracefully, his arms fully extended in what James could only see as a Christ-like pose, his head arched back as if he were looking at the sky. James was sure that he would reach the water, but at the last instant, the back of Lucan Adler's head hit the concrete seawall with a sound that could be heard all the way to where James and the other men stood numbly, dumbly. Then James saw Holmes either let go or lose his grip, and he dropped at least 40 feet, but to the water just short of the concrete slabs that supported the beacon light post. James, Drummond, and two of the agents leaned forward and strained to see if Holmes came to the surface. Drummond looked through his binoculars and then handed them to James. Holmes hadn't come up. He hadn't come up. He still hadn't come up. But suddenly, Holmes could be seen weakly pulling himself up and over the gunwales of the powerboat that Lucan Adler had anchored there. The bloodied Holmes lay on his back on the bottom of the boat and did not move again. Drummond took back the binoculars and stared. "I think he's breathing. Here come the boats." From behind the mass of the SS Michigan warship came roaring 8 police boats, 3 belonging to the Chicago Police Force and 5 belonging to the Columbian Guard. They all slowed and centered on the boat where Holmes lay bleeding. James saw a man with a doctor's bag step into the blood-washed boat. Then James had to sit down on the pavement, sit, and try to breathe. Drummond crouched next to him and lifted the Mauser with his left hand while patting James on the back with his right. James shoved the rifle away from him. He knew he would never touch one again as long as he lived. Once again, he thought of his brothers Wilkie and Bob, who had carried such death with them into the war, and, even after their terrible wounds and pain and in the presence of real death, eventually rose to carry and use their rifles again. He thought of his cousin Gus, so beautiful that day in the drawing class, whose pale and freckled body was now rotted in mold somewhere under Virginia dirt, after a Confederate sniper had expertly done exactly what James had just tried to do. He shook his head. The joy of dramatic engagement that had affected him like too much strong American whiskey at the Chicago stockyards had drained completely out of him now. It was not worth being a fictional character or a real person, he realized, if ending someone's life through violence was part of the role. It was not civilized. It was not right. It was not Henry James. Nor was it honest to the hard-earned truth of his art.
Lucan Adler's body hasn't come up yet, said one of the agents still standing at the railing.
Drummond crouched next to the seated writer and repeated that to James as if James had become hard of hearing.
I don't care, said James, and lowered his head to his raised knees.
11. Who knew that the World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 had its own infirmary? Actually, it was a well-stocked little hospital with squadrons of nurses and five full-time doctors on duty, one of them a woman. Sherlock Holmes was the seventh person ever brought to the sparkling new infirmary. Four women and two men had fainted during the crush and heat of the opening ceremony, and the two doctors checking him over, neither one a woman, decided to ask a surgeon more skilled in dealing with thoracic wounds to come down from Chicago General and give his opinion. He came, in a police wagon with a siren wailing and horses nearly out of control, and pronounced the wounds simple enough to deal with. No major organs had been punctured or slashed. Holmes received stitches over his lower abdomen, his upper belly, his right ribs, his right wrist, which had a strange but shallow bullet furrow in it, and on his scalp and back. He had a concussion, serious contusions around the head and shoulders, and it turned out that he'd also broken two fingers on his right hand and his right wrist in the scuffling, as doctors who didn't know the details of the opening day's incident called it. Few people ever did hear about this incident. Neither Daniel Burnham, Director Davis, Mayor Harrison, nor President Cleveland wanted word of an assassin's presence or violent death on opening day known. Almost none of the crowd had seen the incident, and most of those few who had thought that it had been a madcap part of the opening ceremony. The press was not told about it. Henry Cabot Lodge's guests didn't mind staying two more days at the fair until Mr. Holmes would be released. It turned out that the concussion was what kept him in bed the longest. On the third day, he left with his torso slightly bound with bandages and his right arm in what he thought was an unnecessary sling, but movement without it hurt his wrist enough that he decided to keep it on for the time being. Both Andrew L. Drummond and Henry James had visited Holmes in the infirmary, and James was there when Drummond told the detective that Irene Adler was in a room on the floor above him, a room guarded 24 hours a day by two armed Colombian guardsmen.
How is she? Asked James.
He had been sure she'd been lying dead up there on the promenade deck.
The slug passed through her shoulder without breaking her collarbone or hitting any major artery, said Drummond. The lady is very lucky. One bone was nicked, but she should heal quickly enough.
Is she going to face charges? Asked Holmes from his hospital bed.
Absolutely, said Drummond.
Charges of what, exactly?
Asked Holmes.
God damn it, said Drummond.
Well, keep a good guard on her, said Holmes. She's a dangerous woman.
Henry James had decided that he was sailing on the United States from New York to Europe, probably to England, but possibly all the way to Genoa, from whence he could travel to Florence and then north to join his brother William's family in Lucerne. Over James's loud and sincere objections, the Lodges and the Camerons decided that they would go home by way of New York, dropping Harry off, perhaps actually seeing him off at the pier, and staying a week or so to allow the wives and Helen to do some serious shopping while the men had some serious conversations with their Wall Street friends and brokers. In Buffalo, New York, they had a 3-hour layover as a new engine was attached to their private train, and that gave everyone time for luncheon at a decent restaurant there and to stretch their legs. James returned early and alone to the personal carriage, and one of the valets who helped him said,
"There is a gentleman waiting in your compartment to see you, Mr. James."
"What the devil is he doing in my compartment?" snapped James.
"He specifically asked to wait there, sir," said the valet, his face crimson with shame. "He said that he knew you, sir. He said that it was vitally important for him to talk to you as soon as you returned, sir. I apologize if I did wrong by allowing him in your private compartment."
James whisked that away with a movement of his hand, but he was not pleased, not pleased at all. James had stepped into his small but luxurious compartment and closed the door behind him, before he realized that it was almost as dark as night in the room. Someone had pulled down both the lighter and darker shades over his compartment's windows. It took James a second to see the man sitting in the easy chair, the chair in the corner near the lamp sconce, the chair James used for reading, and another second to register just who the man was. Professor James Moriarty. The dim light showed the overhang of that luminous, deathly brow, the thin white lips, the cadaverous cheeks and white sticks of hair sticking out over his vulpine ears. The tongue kept darting in its reptilian manner over the dried lips. The nails on the long white fingers were inches long, curved and yellowed with age and evil.
"We meet at last, Mr. Henry James,"
hissed Moriarty, and stood up. Lacking even his walking stick with which to fight, James flung open his compartment door when a too familiar voice behind him said,
"You're not leaving so quickly, are you, James?"
James spun around. Moriarty flung up the shades until the compartment was flooded with light. Then he carefully plucked off his long yellow fingernails one by one. Then he removed all his teeth, changing the shape of his face. Next, the tall man clawed at his own face, pulling off pieces of forehead, cheekbone, nose, and chin, and dropping the fragments on a towel set out for the purpose. The rest of the forehead and bald pate came off in one piece, but with unpleasant ripping sounds. Henry James stood there and watched silently while Holmes used some sort of cream and tweezers to remove the rest of Professor Moriarty's ears, face, chin, and neck. All the detritus piled up on the large towel atop James's dresser.
"You don't have anything to say about my greatest performance?" asked Holmes.
He used James's mirror to brush his hair back into place, and then he put his broken right wrist back into the black sling.
"Why?" asked James.
Holmes grinned and rubbed his hands together while ignoring the sling.
"My brother Mycroft and I have been building this evil genius, Professor Moriarty, for almost 5 years now, James. First it was just the rumor of him in Dr. Watson's little fictions. Then, actual appearances."
"What about the dynamics of an asteroid?" asked James. "It's real. I've seen the book."
"Very real," said Holmes, "and mathematically accurate. Also, they tell me, my brother Mycroft and his old tutor at Christchurch, the Don Charles Lutwidge Dodgson, did the maths for Professor Moriarty's mathematical masterpiece."
"And Moriarty's presence at actual astrophysical conferences, as in Leipzig?" asked James.
"All unappreciated performances by yours truly," laughed Holmes. "But years ago, I discovered something very interesting. If one takes extra efforts to look repulsive, to smell repulsive, and to behave in a repulsive manner, other people take far less close notice of you.
Why?
Asked James, his voice even more tired than before.
Why this elaborate play-acting?
As I said, more than 5 years of elaborate play-acting,
Holmes said softly, sitting on the arm of James's reading chair. James crossed the compartment and sat on the bed. His face was expressionless. Outside, others were returning from their dining and excursions in Buffalo.
Moriarty brought regular criminals into a true network of crime, said Holmes. As Moriarty, I guided them into masterpieces of criminal endeavor. £500,000 in scrip from the Second Reserve Bank in London. £1,000,000 in pure gold bullion from the Burn Gold Depository. Hundreds of thousands of dollars from the Farmers Trust Bank in Kansas City. 500,000,000 lira from Rome's central...
all right, interrupted James. So I'm sitting and talking to a felon. Someone who's created successful criminal networks and robberies in America, England, and on the continent for 5 years now. Why are you still free?
All the brilliant Moriarty triumphs were orchestrated through Mycroft and Whitehall, the local constabularies, and the local banks, depositories, whatever, said Holmes. The stolen scrip turned out to be the highest quality Her Majesty's government could counterfeit, and by tracking it, we traced a diagram of more than a dozen criminal mobs in London, Liverpool, Birmingham, even Cambridge.
What about the gold? Said James.
The criminals had their gold verified by experts, said Holmes, but Mycroft and his friends took no chances. We provided the experts.
What about the anarchists? Asked James. Remember, I was at your Washington meeting of thugs and socialists.
Holmes shook his head in what seemed to be admiration.
And I shall forever admire your courage and initiative in doing so, said the detective. I simply could not tell you about our plans when you shared this vital information with me.
Plans?
On May 1st, in 23 cities in 9 nations, the police and authorities have rounded up criminals and anarchists pledged to destroy their societies.
And what will they be charged with?
Asked James, putting only a fraction of the contempt he felt into the sarcasm in his tone.
Loitering as a group? Unseemly appearance in public?
95% of the criminals we've enlisted, and who gathered for the big riots and big hauls on May 1st, had warrants out for them already, said Sherlock Holmes. Many in more than one country. For the anarchists, those who showed up at the designated places with bombs and guns will be charged immediately. The rest put on a watch list.
So you and your brilliant brother Mycroft invented Professor James Moriarty, went to great pains to give him a believable mathematical background, turned him into the Napoleon of crime, and then had the fictional villain kill you at Reichenbach Falls in Switzerland, to free you up, I presume, to spend 3 years running around in your little Moriarty disguise, enlisting burglars and anarchists.
Yes, said Holmes. That is about it. I did ask for 6 months of my own time after my death at Reichenbach Falls, so I could visit Tibet and ask some questions of the Dalai Lama. But that became a rather longer stay due to young Lucan's skill with a rifle.
3 bullets through you, Henry James said softly. I saw the size of those rounds. Cartridges, bullets, whatever you call them. When I worked the bolt action of that Mauser and one ejected, it was huge. How could you not have died?
Perhaps I did, said Holmes.
To hell with this metaphysical tommy rot you've been shoveling onto me since we met, snapped James, standing suddenly. You can go spend the rest of your life, if it is a life, asking yourself and everyone you meet if you're real.
Sooner or later, some drunk in some pub, smelling of urine and sweat, will give you a definitive answer.
I've already received a good answer, Holmes said softly. Just a few days ago.
James said nothing.
Have you ever heard of singing yourself into existence? Asked Holmes. Or others singing someone, perhaps you, into existence, by telling stories about them? Passing the stories along? Is that what you're doing with your writing, Henry James? Singing yourself into greater existence every day you work at your craft?
James ignored all that twaddle.
Why, he said sharply, were you and a bunch of thugs at the Central Chicago Railway Station that Saturday morning when I was trying to get to New York?
Looking for you, James. And the thugs were some of Colonel Rice's men he loaned me. There were too many carriages for me to check in the short time before your scheduled train left.
Why were you, as Professor Moriarty, looking for me when I was trying to get out of all this, leave this fever dream, and go home to England?
Holmes stood.
I was going to show you my Moriarty disguise that morning and ask you not to leave yet, to see our shared mystery through.
Shared mystery, repeated James, pouring scorn into every syllable.
You never even solved poor dead Ned Hooper's question of who sends those typed cards every December 6. She was murdered, remember?
The game's not over yet, said Holmes.
His bandaged right hand and broken wrist obviously were hurting him, and he shifted his arm in its black sling.
Do you want to know what I think about your precious game? Asked Henry James.
I do, very much, yes, said Holmes.
Henry James had never done this in his life, not even as a boy wrestling with William or Wilkie, not even at his angriest. But now he turned his right hand into the most solid fist he could and hit the great consulting detective Sherlock Holmes on his pointed chin as hard as he could. Holmes flew backward onto the bed, totally surprised. When he could sit up, he used his good left hand to rub his jaw.
I deserved that, I guess, he said softly. I'm sorry, James, especially since I've come to think of you as a friend. And I really have no friends.
James turned and left his own compartment and walked forward through carriages until he reached the ladies' common area, where he sat and listened to them for a while, pretending to be the tame cat that he often longed to be. Holmes waited until a stop in Albany, where John Hay and most of the others got out to stretch their legs, before he approached Clara Hay, who had stayed behind with one of her headaches.
May I speak to you privately, Mrs. Hay?
She smiled wanly and touched her temple.
I have a bursting headache right now, Mr. Holmes. Perhaps later?
Now is a better time, Mrs. Hay, said Holmes, and walked into her compartment and sat on a straight-backed chair.
Well, I'll call for some tea, said Clara Hay.
When the serving girl hurried in with a tray of hot tea and plates of scones and biscuits, Holmes said,
You may step out now and close the door behind you, Sally.
Shocked at the man in Mrs. Hay's compartment giving her orders, Sally looked to Clara Hay to see what to do. Mrs. Hay also looked shocked, or at least nonplussed, but she nodded for Sally to leave. Then she sat in her over-cushioned embroidering chair, about as far away from Holmes as she could get in a train compartment, even a luxury train compartment.
What is it, Mr. Holmes?
She asked in a tiny voice.
Shouldn't John be here to be part of this discussion?
No,
said Holmes. He picked up his cup of tea and saucer, added a bit of cream, and drank the steaming liquid. Clara Hay remained very, very still, and watched him as if she had found herself in a room with a rattlesnake.
I know that you typed and delivered all the "she was murdered" cards, Clara, said Holmes. You should probably stop doing that now.
That is the most offensive and ridiculous thing that I have ever, began Clara Hay, raising both hands to her cheeks.
You and Mr. Hay stayed 3 days at Mr. Clemens's Hartford home in the year after Clover Adams died, said Holmes. You were often alone, and Clemens even remembered you asking how to operate his new typing gadget.
Ridiculous, managed Clara Hay, but could say no more than that.
I tracked down 2 of Mr. Clemens's servants who remembered the sound of typing coming down from the billiards room when Clemens and Hay had gone out for a walk. And you were alone in the house all afternoon, Clara, said Holmes. But in the end, it was the money, Mrs. Hay, that tipped me off to your involvement.
Money?
In the spring of 1891, shortly before I had to leave for the Reichenbach Falls charade, Clover's brother Ned asked me to come to America to investigate the mystery cards that appeared each year on the anniversary of Clover's death. I've told people the truth, that I took $1 from him so that I would be on retainer and get to the puzzle when I could. Too late for poor Ned, I'm sorry to say. But he offered me $3,000 to come to America right then and to solve this disturbing card case before I went on to anything else.
Ned never had $3,000 in his life, whispered Clara Hay.
Precisely what your husband and Henry Adams said when I mentioned the sum, said Holmes. They insisted that Ned had fantasized that amount of money, Mrs. Hay. But Ned showed me the $3,000 in my room at 221B Baker Street. He begged me to take it and to follow him back to America immediately where, he said, there would be more money if I did my job correctly. I sensed even then that Ned Hooper had never even had the funds to travel to England alone. It was someone else's money, someone else's need for a detective.
Clara Hay looked Holmes in the eye with a bold defiance that he never thought she could muster.
Are you asking for the $3,000 now, Mr. Holmes? Now that you have, how does Dr. Watson put it in the story magazines? Now that you have cracked this insoluble case? Or do you want more, to keep your silence? My private checkbook is here.
She actually removed it and a pen from a drawer in the nearby secretary.
All I want to know is, why, Mrs. Hay? Why 7 years of making sure that all the 4 survivors of the 5 of Hearts received that note every December 6th?
Because I knew something was wrong, said Clara, with a near growl of defiance. I never even liked Clover Adams that much, Mr. Holmes. I thought she was arrogant and condescending and often acting above her real station. We had the 5 of Hearts, Mr. Holmes, but in the 5 p.m. conversations and tea in front of the Adams's fireplace every evening, Clover was always the first heart. Henry Adams and my own John have referred to her that way ever since her suicide, and I wasn't even the 5th heart. The men used to joke with Clarence King that he needed to marry one of his swarthy South Seas women so that we could have a 6th heart. But I was already the 6th heart. Never fast enough with a witty rejoinder. Never witty enough when I did say something. Never knowledgeable enough about any of their fast-moving discussion topics at the right time.
She did not so much stop talking as she just ran down like a wind-up toy. She had been pointing the pen at Holmes like a stiletto or a pistol, but now she capped it and put it back on the secretary with her oversized checkbook.
I knew that when that Rebecca Lorne went out of her way to make friends with poor, lonely, miserable Clover Adams, that someone, most probably Rebecca, or her hideous cousin Clifton, was up to something. Something harmful. Something that would be too much for Clover to handle. I still believe in my heart that this was the reason for Clover's suicide, if suicide it actually was.
The 2 sat in deep silence for several minutes. Finally, Holmes said softly,
"But that's not the real reason you sent Ned Hooper over to London to hire me with that fortune to investigate things about the 5 hearts."
She jerked and then sat absolutely upright. She was almost unable to get her next words out through her tightened throat.
What can you possibly mean?
Mr. Holmes.
The detective reached into his jacket pocket and brought out four letters, each still in its mauve envelope and addressed in John Hay's bold, manly hand.
I've seen you at dinners, Mrs. Hay, Holmes said softly. I watch people and observe. While you are always the perfect hostess, you are also busy observing every word your husband said to the women at the table, every way he spoke to them, observing his every glance and move, especially toward Nanny Lodge, who had these letters from Mr. Hay hidden in her bedroom.
Clara audibly gasped.
How could you possibly? Stealing someone's private correspondence, breaking and entering.
Not at all, Holmes said with a smile. I just had a small and wiry confederate with spiky green hair and instructions on where to look in the places where married women hide love letters from married men, not their husbands. These letters, and others, but these were the important ones, as I suspect you know, were taped to the bottom of Nanny Lodge's lingerie drawer. The same place Lizzie Cameron's love letters from Henry Adams were hidden in her boudoir, thought Holmes. Women are conniving, but I think too much like them to allow them to outsmart me. Then he had to smile. All save for Irene Adler.
Here, said Holmes, and handed her the four letters. She accepted them as Cleopatra must have accepted the serpent that was going to nurse death from her breast.
If I read them,
she began hesitantly.
You'll never forget some of the wording and images, said Holmes. But you need to know that these are always the words and images that men suddenly encountering middle age and their own mortality use in their foolish love letters. It is pure insanity, and purely male insanity.
Clara Hay spoke as if Holmes were not even there.
John used to send me love letters, and wonderful poetry I'd never heard of, and flowers. But then, as I got heavier after the children, I came home from church one Sunday and heard John laughing with that lout Samuel Clemens about how I, this is the way my darling husband put it, Clara didn't get out of the hotel much during our Chicago visit. But she certainly tucked into her victuals with enthusiasm.
She looked at Holmes as if first noticing his presence.
I love John more than life. I've given my life to John and the children. But at that minute I could have shot both him and that idiot Clemens dead on our parlor rug.
Holmes nodded and said nothing. Clara kept staring at the letters, holding the envelopes away from her as if they could strike like serpents.
Won't Nanny Lodge notice that these are missing?
She whispered.
Oh, yes, said Sherlock Holmes and allowed himself his rare grin. She shall. I promise you she shall. And then, well, the concern about where those particular letters might have gone will be very great. I think you will see a change both in Nanny Lodge's behavior and in your husband's. Perhaps a permanent one.
Then I don't really have to read these after all,
she whispered.
No,
said Holmes, and held out his hands, cupped slightly, palms up, as if he were ready to give or accept some holy communion. He saw the recognition ignite in Clara Hay's eyes, and holding one envelope after another over his hands, she tore each into tiny shreds and had Holmes use his fancy cigarette lighter to burn each scrap above an oversized crystal ashtray. Soon, Sherlock Holmes's hands were filled with tiny confetti. Despite the bandage on his right hand, he'd not let one scrap of torn paper escape the flames, and now he used his good left hand to put that confetti into his jacket pocket.
I'm going to go now, Mrs. Hay, he said, standing. Go into the men's room in this station and flush some unwanted and useless scraps of paper down the toilet.
She stared at Holmes with luminous eyes, then touched her checkbook again.
The money?
I never came to America for money's sake, said Holmes. I did so for Ned's sake, and, I think, for yours. Good afternoon, Mrs. Hay. We may not have the chance to talk again until I leave the train in New York.
The revelers gave Henry James a raucous bon voyage party, both at a fine restaurant on 32nd Street and then again at the wharf where the great SS United States was making final preparations to shove off. The tugs were already pushing their netted snouts into position.
"Funny that Holmes didn't come to dinner or stop to say goodbye," mused James when all the farewells fell silent for a moment.
"Perhaps he forgot the time," said Henry Cabot Lodge. "He's always struck me as a preoccupied fellow."
"Perhaps his injuries were bothering him," said young Helen.
"Or more likely, he had another case to solve," said John Hay.
"Well,"
said Senator Don Cameron, his arm around his wife Lizzie, who was smiling at Adams,
"we had about enough of that man's company for one year. But you, Harry, you must hurry back to visit again."
James shook his head. "You need to come to London or Paris or Italy to see me."
Cameron and Lodge exchanged odd glances.
"With the bank and Wall Street panic that we think is coming like a tsunami," said Henry Cabot Lodge, "I suspect that most of New York's, Boston's, and Washington's better families will be living on the cheap in Europe by July or August, leaving their servants here to fend for themselves and their great houses shut up until this particular storm has passed. Then they'll come wandering home in a year or two or three. Those that survive the storm, I mean."
"Now, stop it, darling,"
cried Lizzie Cameron, pretending to hit her husband on the shoulder.
"No gloomy talk while we're wishing Harry bon voyage."
"It's not gloomy if it means you'll be in London to see me soon," said James, and lifted his hat as he walked up the gangplank at the ship's final all-passengers-aboard, all-visitors-ashore whistle of steam.
"Adieu!"
he called over the scream of escaping steam. Epilogue. Henry James hated epilogues and refused to use them in his fiction. He said that life granted us no epilogues, so why should art or literature? Life, as he knew all too well, was just one damned thing after another, and there were no real summings up in life, and definitely no curtain calls. I feel much the same way about epilogues, as you may also, but this one is here, and we have to deal with it. By the last evening on the high seas, the steamer the United States was scheduled to touch at Portsmouth, but then go on to Genoa, where James had decided to start the last leg of his trip to see William and his wife Alice and their children in Lucerne, Henry James was bored. The weather was perfect and the seas so calm that all the experienced travelers and even the crew kept commenting on it. James didn't care to play backgammon or the other silly games going in the common areas, so he read, either in his pleasant cabin or on his pleasant lounge chair, a blanket across his legs and lap, or while lunching alone. He'd been set at a table of important people for every evening's meal, but the men's importance was in business, and Henry James listened and nodded politely, but had little, if anything, to say on the subject. He thought a lot about his play and about these days he was wasting when he should be writing. It was sunset of that fourth evening when James was leaning on the mahogany railing in the first class section, looking behind the ship at its wake and the beautiful sunset into the Atlantic, when he realized that another man had moved very close and was leaning on the rail next to him.
"Holmes!"
he cried, then looked around to see if anyone had noticed his absurd shout. The detective was no longer wearing his sling, but his right hand was still bandaged.
"Why are you here?" asked James. "Where are you going?"
"I believe the ship is headed to Portsmouth, and then on to Genoa," Holmes said softly.
He looked thinner and much more pale than he had in America.
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"That I'd booked passage on the same ship you were taking back to Europe," said Holmes with that thin, fast flick of a smile.
"I didn't think you'd be overjoyed to hear the news. I planned to make the entire crossing, no matter how far you were going, without letting you know I was aboard."
"But where have you been hiding yourself?" asked James.
Again, that flicker that never quite resolved itself into an actual smile.
"If you want the blunt truth, Harry, I've been in my cabin puking my kidneys out and trying not to scream like a gorilla on fire for more than 4 days and nights.
James took half a step back along the rail at the crude language. But the crossing has been so smooth. The ocean's been a mill pond. Even the old ladies who get seasick looking at a large cup of tea have been healthy and busy on this crossing.
Holmes nodded, and James could see that his forehead was beaded with sweat, despite the pleasant coolness of the evening and the ship's movement through the fresh air.
I decided that I had to go off that heroic medicine that I was injecting into myself several times a day there in America, Holmes said softly. Did I mention that heroin substance by name?
No, said James. I wasn't sure what I thought.
Anyway, said Holmes with that smile, even 2 months' use of that stuff makes stopping the use of it a terrible experience. I may see Dr. Watson in the coming months, and he would be most disappointed in me if I came back to England addicted to some new poison.
So you've quit this heroic drug for good?
Oh, yes, said Holmes. But that's not why I came up to find you, James.
Why did you?
Because after my 4.5 days and nights of vomiting, my head was suddenly clear, and I realized why you were so out of sorts and brooding those last days in America.
James looked away and felt the bile rise in his own throat.
It's what I did, he said at last. I shall never truly get over it.
And what do you think you did? Asked Holmes.
James rounded on Holmes with some of the old ferocity in his gray eyes.
I killed a man, Holmes. I shot and killed a human being. He was a villain and deserved to die, but not by my hand. I'm an artist, a creator, not...
He trailed off. That's what I thought you thought, said Holmes. And you're crazy, Henry James. You should have been at the debriefings with Drummond and Colonel Rice and the others after the unpleasantness, rather than wandering away.
What are you talking about, Holmes?
Holmes held up his bandaged right hand and wrist.
Your rifle didn't kill anyone, James.
It passed through Lucan Adler's shirt sleeve, and perhaps brushed him enough to make him flinch and save my life from that blade. Then it burned its way across the back of my hand and went on its merry way into the lake.
You shot and killed no one.
James felt like crying from a sense of relief that almost made him sick, but instead gripped the wooden rail harder and stared into the disappearing sun behind the ship.
Oh, said Holmes, when I was finished with my little drug withdrawal adventure, I realized that I forgot to tell you about 2 relevant telegrams that I received in New York shortly before we sailed.
Holmes took the flimsies from his breast pocket. James, even though he felt that he could take his first deep breath in weeks, listened with some dread.
The first one was from our friend Agent Drummond, and is purely informational, said Holmes, unfurling the folded flimsy with some difficulty with his bandaged hand. I quote, "Please be informed that Irene Adler escaped custody at the Columbian Exposition Infirmary the day after you left Chicago. Stop. Guard members found that she had cut her hair over the sink quite short, we believe, and that one of their own guardsmen had been overpowered, stripped of his outer clothing, tied and gagged, and stuffed in a closet. Stop. Irene Adler may have escaped in a Colombian guardsman uniform posing as a man. Stop. Be on the lookout for a woman with her left arm still in a sling. Stop. She may be armed and is considered extremely dangerous. Stop. Drummond."
James hadn't meant to, but he started laughing and found it difficult to stop. Holmes joined in, and it only made James laugh the harder. He really couldn't have said why he was laughing so hard. It's just that everything unreal finally felt over.
This telegram I received in New York right before we sailed will sober you up fast enough, James, I assure you.
Holmes unfolded the flimsy and read carefully, in a slightly deeper voice than usual.
From my brother Mycroft, who never concerns himself about the cost of extra words in a telegram. Neither of us does. From Mycroft, Sherlock,
imperative that you continue on to Genoa aboard the ship United States, and then make your way north to Lucerne, Switzerland, as quickly as you can. Stop. I will be there in 10 days. Stop. This is a conference of international importance. Stop. Your presence imperative. Stop. Mycroft.
Holmes tucked away the telegram flimsies, and the two men looked bleakly at each other.
Your older brother and my older brother both in Lucerne?
Said Henry James in a disbelieving, stunned voice.
And us there with them? Inconceivable.
I agree, Holmes said glumly.
Suddenly, a young man with his heavy coat thrown over his shoulders and an oversized derby pulled down absurdly low walked past. The youthful voice said,
Good evening, Mr. Holmes.
James jerked his head around but caught only a glimpse of the young man's strong chin, high cheekbones, and dark hair, clipped American military short on the sides and in back.
Friend of yours? Asked Henry James.
The sun had disappeared. All the ship's electric lights came on suddenly, brilliantly, the way they had at the Chicago World's Fair that opening night. Before the lights came on like fireworks, in the gloom and instant of the youths passing them, Sherlock Holmes had seen the young man's left arm in a black sling under the open, caped overcoat. Holmes passed his good arm through Henry James's and leaned with the older man over the railing. The sea air was so fresh as to be intoxicating.
We'll deal with Lucerne and older brothers when we come to them, Holmes said,
sounding happy for the first time since Henry James had first met him that rainy night along the Seine, 2 months earlier.
In the meantime, my friend, said Holmes, this could turn out to be a very interesting journey, after all.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Fifth Heart, written by Dan Simmons, read by David Pitu, produced and directed by Cheryl Smith, recorded by Charles McCrory, post-production by Beat Street Productions. The Fifth Heart is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown and Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Dan Simmons. Audio production copyright 2015 Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook without the permission of the publisher constitutes unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events, or locales is entirely coincidental.